Welcome to the Lost Together podcast with Matt Wardlaw.
This week, our guest is Howard Jones. I can still remember bringing home a vinyl copy of Howard's Dream Into Action album back in 1985, and it would be another decade before I saw Howard live for the first time in 1996 here in Cleveland at the Odeon Concert Club. I was glad that I finally got the opportunity to do that because he had played Cleveland on the tour for In the Running in a similarly acoustic format, and I missed that show. So it was nice to have another crack at seeing Howard playing live, and because he was promoting the Live Acoustic America album that had been recorded during that tour, he was performing again in the acoustic vein with percussionist Carol Steele on board. It was a great show, and from that point, I saw Howard a number of times over the subsequent years. He continued to play acoustic shows here in the U.S., and the electric synthesizer-based shows seemed to be something that you had to go to the U.K. to see. It wasn't until the summer of 2008 that I finally had a chance to see Howard play his electric set when he played a festival bill in Dayton, Ohio. 2014 brought Howard to Cleveland for the first time here in present day with his electric band as part of the Retro Futura tour, and he was back last year for an intimate electric show at the Trinity Cathedral, which you'll hear us discuss during today's interview. Now this summer, Howard is on the road for what is surprisingly his longest North American tour ever. He's touring along with OMD as the support for Bare Naked Ladies, and if you've been following Howard's social media on Twitter at Howard Jones and on Facebook, it looks like the tour has been going really, really well. A few days before the tour began, I had the chance to speak with Howard to talk about the tour, the new music that he's got in the works, and a number of other subjects. As always, check out the Lost Together website at losttogetherpod.com for a complete archive of all the shows to date, and you can subscribe there via RSS and iTunes. Email me at losttogetherpod@gmail.com and follow along on Twitter and Facebook at losttogetherpod. Besides his Twitter and Facebook presence, howardjones.com is the main informational hub where you can get all of the latest Hojo news details, merchandise, and tour information. Here's my chat with Howard. We begin by talking about this being his longest tour ever in North America. Thank you so much for listening.
I have done, you know, loads of gigs in the time, but I don't think I've ever done like 45 in one sort of in one continuous row. I think that's what it is.
Well, you certainly have been touring America a lot. Over the recent years. It's got to be great for you to be able to take this this electric set out for such an extensive run of the States.
Yeah, it is, and I am. I'm going to be playing some places that, you know, I haven't been to before, which is very exciting for me, and some venues that I haven't played, and, you know, so America's so big, it's just like, you know, to cover the whole place is really, you know, you have to travel a lot.
Yeah, for sure, and you're on a bill with Bare Naked Ladies for a lot of these shows, and I want to talk about those guys in a second, but also OMD, I mean, that's another great thing about this tour, that it's been such a long time since OMD has done any sort of real touring here in America, and I know you've got some history with those guys. I wondered kind of what your memories are of crossing paths with them in the 80s.
Yeah, well, you know, right in the very early days, I opened up to them. I think it was a gig in Cardiff, and I think there was a gig, I'm not quite sure where the other one was, but, you know, it was like, I think it was 1983. It was like before, you know, my first single came out even, you know, it was really early days. So I got to meet them then. So, and funnily enough, just recently, I've been involved in this Eddie the Eagle film. I wrote a couple of songs for it and Andy also was involved in writing something for that film as well. So we met up at the launch, and we still get on really, really well. So I think that's always a bonus, you know, when you go on tour and there's people you know and you've got a history with. So yeah, it's great. And I suppose we do have a bit of a crossover audience as well, you know.
How did you get involved with the Eddie the Eagle stuff?
Well, Gary Barlow, who was putting the original songs together, gave me a call and said, look, the idea was to, because the film is set in the 80s, his idea was to write some new songs, but like really use the language, you know, the sonic language of that time. And so that really appealed to me, especially when he sent me the script, which was so good. And it was such an inspiring story of Eddie the Eagle that I, you know, I jumped on it, really. And I wrote two songs very quickly. I was hoping to sort of collaborate with Jack Parlow on it, but we were never in the same continent. And, you know, I was doing so much touring and he was doing a lot of touring. And so in the end, I just did the tracks and sent them to him, and he just loved them. So, you know, I would have liked to work together, though, on something, because I think I'm a great admirer of his work.
So this particular tour happening this summer, how did the idea for this tour kind of come together?
Well, I mean, you know, I didn't have, I was just invited to be on it. The Bare Naked Ladies, I think, you know, selected people that they would like to have on the tour. And I think looking at the lineup, you know, I mean, it's not an obvious pairing, but I think the great thing about that is that we get to play to a new audience, like both of us, you know, the Bare Naked
sure.
Ladies. And so that's always fun, because it's always fun to like open up the music to new people, and it's challenging, you know. So I think it's going to be a great tour, and I hope to do a song with Bare Naked Ladies, you know, in their set as well, which is very cool.
Oh, cool! That'd be awesome. Have you guys talked about that at this point?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes, yes. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. Yeah, yeah. We've been talking about it the last few weeks in rehearsals and stuff.
Well, I know that the Bare Naked Ladies guys, like, they did the tour last summer with Violent Femmes and Colin Hay, and it's funny because you mentioned this, but it's like I've heard some folks talk about how the pairing seems like kind of an odd match, but, I mean, it makes good sense to me because, you know, those guys, they've always seemed like they're big music fans to me, so it's not hard to see how their input into this, how it would come together this way, and I think it's cool.
Oh, yeah. That's right. You know, you can tell they're really into music, and they're really, they're very knowledgeable about music. Some of the comments that I got back about, you know, which version of the song would you like us to do, you know, and I was like, wow, you know all the details. So yeah, it was great. So yeah, I'm, you know, very. I think it's going to be a very sort of harmonious tour. I think that there's going to be a lot of laughter and fun.
Can we count on you to bring the keytar out for this tour?
What I've been trying to do is use the keytar more than I've ever done before on this tour. So my idea was to be as mobile as possible. So I've tried to, not be stuck behind my main keyboard. In certain things I have to, you know, when I'm playing piano, related stuff where I've got to have two hands on the go and, you know, but there's a lot of stuff that I can do, you know, mobile, and I've tried to work that into the show. So I'm going to be moving around a lot more on this one.
Is there any sort of fun story behind that keytar and kind of its personal history in your collection?
Well, it's very interesting to talk about, because you see, right back in 1983, I used to strap a Moog Prodigy around my neck using a guitar strap.
Yeah,
and then
nice.
Have you seen pictures of that?
I have, yeah.
So I didn't even know, you know, and I think there was and then when they finally brought one, a proper guitar out, which was the KX5, which was the Yamaha KX5, I jumped on that straight away, and it, you know, anything that could make me more mobile, I was really into. So it's been really part of my history. It's right back, you know, going back to 1982. So I think I must have been one of the first, you know, first people to sort of use keytars a lot.
Well, and currently, I mean, you're doing your part to keep the keytar out there, and that's not a bad thing. You're kind of if it went away, you're bringing it back.
Yeah. The only thing that I would say is that most of them that you see just look ridiculous on people because they're so big.
Yeah.
And they just look like they've got like this ridiculous sort of appendage strapped to them. And I've always gone for the ones that have got the small scale keys so that they look more like guitar size. You know, they don't look like you're wearing a wardrobe or something, you know, when you're coming out there.
Yeah, I think when my wife and I saw you this past year at Trinity Cathedral here in Cleveland, I think...
Oh, that was... I loved that show. That was so great.
It was such a cool and intimate, like, beautiful space to be able to see not only you, but see, like, the electric set. It was such a cool way to see that show.
I've watched the footage of it back because they filmed it that night, and I thought, it's such a strange mix because it's actually the... You know, with the screen and everything, it is the full show, but it's surprisingly intimate at the same time. Because I'm like right in with the audience, you know, like everyone's like dancing just at the front there, and it's in this amazing space. Now, I really enjoyed that gig.
It was well equipped for your show because it's like, I mean, you know, it's like it had like the sanctuary steps, so it's like you were able just to come walking straight down with the guitar and go out in the crowd and go around. So it was a good time. I remember seeing that when that show was announced, like, I figured just because of the space that it was in, I was like, oh, he's probably going to do an acoustic gig. So it was really cool that it ended up being the electric set. So
Yeah, that's right. And they managed to get me an LED screen, which was quite an unusual height. So you got the visuals were sort of condensed, and it looks really cool.
Well, one of the most recent things that you have done musically was the Engage project, and at that time, you told me how you were kind of viewing that as more of an audiovisual release than an album, and how you were kind of probably going to base writing in the future around the live experience. And I wondered if you could talk a bit more, kind of where your head is at with all that presently, because as I understand it, you've got a few things in the pipeline that you're working on album-wise.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed working on Engage because, you know, it was challenging and trying to pull a lot of things together, you know, the visuals and the dance elements of the ballet and just, as you said, you know, think of it as a live experience that people are going to have. So I started, you know, the new album. I've got 10 tracks ready. I haven't finished the lyrics and all the melodies yet, but they've been started. And so I'm thinking of, from the point of view, how do I present these tracks live? So I'm already thinking of how I structure the recording to do it in an interesting way live. So from what I've learned from Engage, you know, so that will be the second part of the, I'm calling it a quadrilogy. There's going to be 4 albums. Engage was the first, and there's going to be another 3. That will all have, you know, a lot of visual elements, and there'll be films, and you know, it'll be an experience live, and then there'll be another 2 after that, and then I hope to sometime in the future perform them all together consecutively. So that's my plan.
You kind of mentioned this, but how did the experience of mounting the whole Engage thing, how did that kind of shape where you have headed with the music that you're working on now?
Well, I sort of freed myself up with Engage to really do you know, much more experimental things, and you know, like the 5 pianos piece, which is, you know, a tribute to Steve Reich, really, and then there was the sort of classical sister brother, you know, it's a classical piano piece, really, and then there's a full on electronic, you know, it's a real eclectic mix of all the things I love. I thought for this next project I would actually write songs this time, but the way that I orchestrate them and reveal them will be based on a kind of build, you know, from maybe just a single voice at the beginning to, you know, the big, you know, full-on electronic, you know, dance raving thing at the end. So so I mean, I'm not quite sure how it's going to turn out, but I'm thinking of you know, of the live show, how it would look.
Well, I mean, the Engage project, I mean, creatively, that must have been really fun for you because, I mean, it really was shaped in real time, it seems like, with the help of the audience. And it must have been interesting kind of seeing where that went as a creative type, like how far you could take it, how far was too far, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to have toured properly with it, you know, but it was just too big of a show for me to manage with the sort of, you know, audiences that I can draw. So really, in the end, we only did four or five of them. But the thing is, when you do something new like that and you put that on, you learn so much, and it just gives momentum to all the other work. So, I see it as that. It's like R&D, you know, for my development as an artist and as a performer.
Well, it seems like you're really fortunate working independently as you have since the 90s. I mean, obviously it leaves you wide open to pursue these projects in the way that you want to. But I guess you also have to look at the things you're doing from a business side. And I wondered how hard it is for you to find that balance.
Well, I just think it's just being, you know, realistic. To be able to fund projects like Engage, which is entirely, you know, funded by me, because I don't have a record company and I don't have, you know, a sort of sugar daddy in the background. That makes you be very practical about how to achieve great things with, you know, and I think it really makes you more creative. And so, you know, there's some gigs that I do, you know, I do more to, you know, get money in so I can then do projects like Engage. But it's really investing in doing, it's just being realistic. Because there's so many artists who, you know, don't have an eye on that, and they end up like not being able to do what they want to do. And my idea is that I always want to be able to fund great ideas, you know, and present them to my great, you know, supporters and fans, and thrill them, you know, with something new.
What do you think about the whole crowdfunding side of things? Because you've done some of that as well.
No, I think that's great. We did that with the Engage project, and what that does, it makes you very, it connects you a lot with, even more with the fans, and, you know, you feel very responsible to deliver, you know, they're believing in you, and they're putting their money up front, you know, to fund the project, so you really feel this great responsibility towards them, but at the same time you think, wow, it's really worth doing this because people really want me to do it, you know, and it's not just me, it's like they're saying, no, go on, Howard, you know, do it. I really think that it is a great model, and I've been encouraging young artists that I know to go that route, especially for their first album, so that it's a very real thing, you know, they make that connection with the fans, and then they are able to fund their first album, and then, you know, those people who've been part of that project will probably be with you for your whole career, you know. And so I'm actually a big fan of the crowdfunding model, as long as the artists, you know, aren't flaky about it, and they make sure that they deliver, you know, what they're going to do. So yeah, it's good.
Well, you probably like having a chance to give back to those young artists, like some of the, I guess, knowledge that might not have been there for you. I know that you're like involved with that artist coalition, but you know, obviously, there's a lot of things that you can share that maybe you weren't aware of when you first started out.
You know what? It's very interesting because the world is changing so fast. I don't even think that the experiences that I had right in the beginning of my career are even vaguely relevant. The only things I think that are the philosophical elements, which is, if you want to have a long career, then you must look after your audience and your fans. You must care for them, and you really must build them into your thinking. So now how you do that is according to the technology available at the time or the thinking that's available at the time. So, and I, you know, and things like, you know, always stay true to what you want to do as an artist, and don't be persuaded to go and do things that are totally not you and totally against your values. So, yeah. You know what I mean? It's like you could. I can say, oh well, you know, I played the pubs and clubs, and I sold cassettes, and you know, and I, yeah, well, that's not relevant now, you know, in
right,
this
right.
day and age, it's not. But still, the things that are, are, you know, look after the fans, care about them, and then they'll stay with you and you can continue to do what you do.
And you've been in pretty close communication with your fans for a long time. I mean, certainly you were pretty early on the whole internet side of things. It must have been pretty interesting for you as an artist to see that feedback become a lot more instant once you got online.
Yes, it is. And I mean, you know, I sort of only wish really I could do more, but if you can't do as much as you'd really like to do because you'd never get anything done. So I try and do, you know, as much as I can to keep in touch. And my main thing is Twitter, which is like short, sharp comments and information and replies. And then I have somebody who, you know, does more, you know, helps me with Facebook. But, you know, it can be that, you know, it's almost like one of the things you should have, if you're forming a band today, one of the members of the band should be the social media guy or girl.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And that's all they do. That's all they do. They haven't got time to play an instrument. You know, they've got to be doing the social media stuff 24/7.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because I know that you were a big Keith Emerson fan, what did you, you know, kind of take away from his, you know, music early on as you were, you know, your early experiences with his music, listening to it?
Well, I mean, I'm still feeling devastated about his suicide, and yeah. I'm devastated. You know, I followed Keith since from the time he was in the Nice. You know, I learned to play "Hang On to a Dream," you know, the piano solo on the early Nice album, and then I was there at the Isle of Wight Festival when ELP did their first major gig, and you know, I was totally blown away with it. And then Keith came to my house to interview me, you know, and spent a whole day with me, and we just had the most amazing time. And I was actually speaking to Carl Palmer just before I left, and Carl's organising like a tribute to him in the UK. I know he's doing one in America as well, but I'm going to be part of that one in the UK. I definitely want to pay my respects, you know, to such an inspirational man.
Yeah, I mean, he was a true trailblazer for sure.
Absolutely, you know. I mean, interestingly enough, you know, Jimi Hendrix was on the same bill. So he was like the king of guitar, and then Emerson was the king of the keyboard, you know, and it was like, it was amazing, two giants
so
in the same place.
What were the circumstances that he came to interview you? Like when was that?
It was in the late 80s, I can't remember.
Yeah.
It was the Keyboard magazine. And I think I was just releasing something like Cross That Line.
Yeah.
And he came to hang out, or, you know, and talk to me about the album. And you know, we played keyboards together, and it was great. We just got on so well. I suppose it's not surprising, really, because, I don't know, it's the same sort of DNA, I guess. You know, a keyboard player who is the front man.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
I mean, there's not many of them, so... So we, you know, we had that in common, and the fact that he inspired me so much, and, you know, also that was the first time I'd heard a Moog, a synthesizer on stage, you know, being sounding so amazing. So that was a huge thing too.
So as I understand, I mean, you had a prog band pretty early on, and you did some pretty epic stuff. How did it happen that you eventually kind of rein things in and shift towards more pop-driven songwriting? What kind of stuff was kind of driving you in that direction?
Well, I suppose I really found, you know, what I really loved, and you know, I loved the pop song form. You know, how beautiful it is. It's a very sort of familiar shape, but there's all kinds of little twists and turns you can give to it. You know, and surprising things you can do with it. And I think, you know, three, four minutes, you know, is a wonderful amount of time to work with. And, you know, I really put all my efforts into that. I'd done the 20-minute compositions that changed time signature, and and keys, and I, you know, I kind of done all that with my in my early days, and then I realized actually that what I was best at was melody, and you know, drawing lyrics together with melody and chord shapes and structures, and so yeah, so that's what I concentrated on.
It's interesting, though. I mean, it always seems like you've felt free to explore things musically and stretch out. I mean, something like Hide and Seek is one that comes to mind, but there's a lot of that stuff sprinkled throughout your catalog.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, you can still, you know, that still has like a pop song structure.
Mm-hmm.
It is expanded, but you know, you can condense it down to a very tight, you know, verse, chorus, you know, verse, bridge, chorus, and you know, middle eight, and yeah, you know. I love all that.
How much time did you spend, like, tinkering with those old songs? Like, it seems like it was probably really fun to, like, you know, kind of put together the structure of all those songs, whether it was a song like New Song or, you know, Always yeah. Always Asking Questions, whatever it was.
Well, the songs on Humans Live were really written with my one-man band rig, you know, that I used to go out and play live with. So I had an eight-note sequencer, so I could have that doing like an ostinato, and I could transpose that. So that was a limitation, but it led to the way that those songs were constructed. And, you know, I could have pads, I could play with my right hand, I could play bass with my left, and do solos, you know, like the New Song solo with my right hand. And, you know, I had arpeggios going, and then the triggers from the 808 drum machine. So That was my instrument. So those songs were very much written according to the capacity of the gear at the time. So, and I think that's why it sort of sounded quite unusual.
It really did, like, which is why it seems like it must have been fun to come up with those sounds. You talked about the capacity of that gear. How well did what you want to do creatively and musically translate to the records that you ultimately made in that time period?
Oh yeah, well I mean I basically set up that live rig, you know, in the studio. It was right in between the speakers, and then I was fortunate to work with Rupert Hine and Stephen Taylor, who were at the cutting edge of technology themselves. And so they brought sampling to, you know, there was primitive sampling available, and then Rupert's great sense of structure that he taught me, and how to build a track from, you know, don't give it all away in the first in the first verse, and you know, that all that amazing thinking and harmonies, and you know, I had a masterclass from Rupert on how to make great records. So you know, it was a combination of that, you know, coming in with all the material ready to go, and then you know, Rupert and Steve taking it to another level.
Well, what else is on deck for you this year besides the stuff that we've talked about and obviously the upcoming tour?
Well, you know, I've got the tour. We're going to Australia in November. I think we're going to South America in September, but I'm pretty sure we are. And then I'm going to be sort of working on the new album over the Christmas time.
Cool.
And then preparing, you know, for what, you know, how to get that out to people next year. So, yeah, you know, it's busy.
Well, final bit here, I'll leave you here with, and that just is with the 25th anniversary of In the Running on tap next year. What comes to mind when you look back at the experience of making that record?
In the Running, yeah. You know, I did that with Ross Cullum, who's really such a talented producer and a musician himself, and yeah, I mean, I think we did a lot of great things on that record. It was mixed by Bob Clearmountain, and it's a great sounding record. It's quite sophisticated, I think, you know. I don't know, you know, I don't know what to say about it other than that. You know, all the five albums from the Warners era I'm really, really proud of, you know.
Yeah, totally.
And it's just, you know, in a way, it's a shame that, you know, they kind of, Warners had lost interest in me by then, and so, you know, it didn't get the push that that maybe it could have had. But that was fine, because then I went on to, you know, have my own label, and that was great.
Yep, I'd say everything from there has it's been good. It's been real good stuff. Well, thank you so much for the time, and I'll let you run, and we'll look forward to seeing you here in Cleveland.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much, and see you in Cleveland.